Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. You're listening to the Project 2025 What's in It podcast, a special series from KALW Public Media about the far right's agenda outlined in what they're calling Project 2025 Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. This Heritage Foundation-led plan lays out a comprehensive agenda to transform the United States into a conservative Christian nation under Donald Trump. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. One note before we dig in. When this show originally aired live on KALW, we took calls and emails. If you have a comment or perspective to share, email us at project2025@kalw.org. Today, we continue our series on Project 2025 by discussing plans to steal the election and abortion. A new Media Matters report has found significant ties between authors, contributors, and partner organizations involved in Project 2025 and the ongoing right-wing efforts to disenfranchise voters and sow confusion about the election, which is in just 12 days. The Heritage Foundation leads Project 2025 and is a central hub in the election denial and voter suppression movement. Heritage Foundation senior legal fellow Hans von Spakovsky has a decades-long career pushing voter fraud myths. He leads Heritage's election law reform initiative and reportedly helped develop its flawed and misleading election fraud database. That database, quote, substantially inflates and exaggerates the occurrence of voter fraud, according to the Brennan Center for Justice. The Media Matters report exposes several groups organizing to steal and sow doubt about the election. They include the Only Citizens Vote Coalition, America First Legal, Tea Party Patriots, and Turning Point USA. Joining us is Madeline Peltz, co-author of the Media Matters report. Madeline is Deputy Director of Rapid Response at Media Matters, a nonprofit watchdog journalism organization. Hi, Madeline. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to ask you an overall question about media coverage of Project 2025. You all at Media Matters wrote a definitive guide to Project 2025 a couple months ago, and you write that this is an extreme right-wing initiative organized by the Heritage Foundation to provide policy and personnel to the next Republican presidential administration. The effort involves more than 100 partner organizations, a database of potential MAGA staffers, a secret 180-day plan, and its nearly 900-page policy book. Now, we've been doing an ongoing series on Project 2025, Madeline, and it has gotten a lot of attention. But I feel like in the last month or two, that attention has really dipped. You all at Media Matters do a great job of just monitoring media across the board. So given that we're 12 days out until the election, what are your thoughts about coverage of Project 2025 over the past few weeks?
I agree with you 100%. I've seen the coverage dip in the mainstream media. It really peaked over the summer after Media Matters published a clip showing the president of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, saying that they were engaged in a, quote, bloodless revolution. And that really what brought Project 2025 to the forefront of the conversation over the summer that coincided with the excitement over Kamala Harris's candidacy for president. And in the last few weeks, a lot of the coverage of the election has turned to polls and horse race politics, who's ahead, who's behind. And as this race has tightened, the policy conversation has really unfortunately fallen to the wayside. So anytime we applaud anytime the mainstream media takes the lead on covering Project 2025. You saw the New York Times fortunately publish a major report yesterday about the overlap between Project 2025 and Trump's inner circle. But more coverage is definitely needed so that voters know what's at stake in this upcoming election. question.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point. I've been watching the cable shows too much over the last few weeks, and they're focusing so much on just the horrible things that Trump says on the campaign trail, him swaying to the music, saying, get your fat ass off the couch and go vote. And they're focusing so much on that, but so little on actual policies. Are you seeing this across the board, given that you all cover what the media says and doesn't say about what's at stake in this election?
Yeah, I'm hoping that the mainstream media can do both in these final 12 days. The behavior we're seeing from Donald Trump is concerning, it's fascistic, it's erratic, and deserves to get coverage. Also important are the universe of national security officials and military officials that have described Trump as a wannabe dictator and fascist who admires Hitler and authoritarian regimes. But at the same time, the gap that the Trump campaign has left by creating this circus around the gap they've left in the policy area is really where Project 2025 fills in the blank. As your listeners likely know, there is a 900 plus page policy book that details in excruciating detail what a second administration would prioritize, and it is essentially a radical reshaping of the federal government, the federal judiciary, and the role of civil rights in your life and mine. And it's of paramount importance that really should be at the forefront of newspaper and cable news coverage.
And just to let listeners know, because so much is moving so quickly, we talked a few days ago about General Mark Milley saying that Donald Trump is fascist to the core. He told Bob Woodward that, and it's in his new book called War. And then John Kelly, the Trump White House's longest serving chief of staff, told the New York Times that Donald Trump meets the definition of a fascist and would rule like a dictator. And then a lot of people are talking about this Jeffrey Goldberg article in The Atlantic. Trump said, I need the kind of generals that Hitler had. So those things should be discussed, but also the policies should be discussed. Before we talk about your new report about ongoing efforts to disenfranchise voters, sow confusion about the election, and then potentially try to steal the election. What in Project 2025 concerns you the most that you don't think is getting the attention it deserves?
Well, I think the plans to consolidate the executive's power around the implementation of the rule of law is perhaps one of the most radical and threatening proposals in Project 2025. The policy book makes the argument that the Department of Justice, which is meant to be an independent agency that upholds the rule of law, is not actually independent, but it is essentially an extension of the president's agenda. And as Trump has articulated for years, on the campaign trail, the priority of his administration will be to pursue retributional prosecutions of his political enemies. And I think that that is perhaps the most not widely understood by the public just how radical that proposal is. To support that agenda, another focus of Project 2025 is staffing the federal bureaucracy with pro-Trump loyalists who would implement an illegal and unconstitutional application of the law. They would strip existing public servants who are nonpartisan and nonpolitical of their worker protections. Fire them en masse and replace them with up to 50,000 loyalists within the federal bureaucracy that are willing to violate the law on behalf of Trump. And so that has trickle-down effects across American society that really is just the type of thing that keeps you up at night.
We're joined today by Madeline Peltz. Deputy Director of Rapid Response at Media Matters, a nonprofit watchdog journalism organization. They've done extensive coverage of Project 2025, and they're out with a new report that exposes ties between Project 2025 and the ongoing right-wing efforts to disenfranchise voters and sow confusion about the election. So in the new report, you point out that the Heritage Foundation, which is leading Project 2025, is at the center of many of the efforts to disenfranchise voters and ultimately steal the election. You point out that the New Yorker's Jane Mayer identified the Heritage Foundation as one of the election denial movement's leaders. Following the 2020 election, Heritage has extensive connections to election denial groups through both direct collaboration on voter suppression policies and the Project 2025 Advisory Board, which includes more than 110 conservative groups. So lay out what you all found in this report.
We put out a new report yesterday that points out how the Heritage Foundation, in collaboration with 10 other major players that are part of Project 2025, have engage in efforts to attempt to steal or otherwise undermine confidence in the election. So the Project 2025 has multiple components. One of them is an advisory board that includes, as you mentioned, over 100 organizations in the conservative movement. And these organizations share common funding. They sometimes share common personnel, and they certainly work together to align their agenda. One component of this agenda that is of paramount importance at the moment is, of course, the integrity of the upcoming 2024 election. So in collaboration with the Heritage Foundation, these members of the advisory board are engaged in bad faith lawsuits to try to disenfranchise voters. They are putting out false information to sow confusion and undermine public confidence, and false reports, particularly about this myth of non-citizen voting. So they're really flooding the zone with disinformation that they would then capitalize not just to shape public opinion, but also to initiate a larger legal strategy to undermine the election and tip it for Trump.
Can you tell us about the money involved in all of this? Because you have cited so many news organizations that have done a very good job of following the money. One example is Heritage gave $100,000 to the Immigration Accountability Project, which fearmongers about the myth of mass voting by non-citizens. The Immigration Accountability Project is a, quote, steering group in the Only Citizens Vote Coalition. And this is according to The Guardian. You know, I have to say, Madeline, sometimes when we do these shows and I mention these groups, it's head spinning, because there are just so many groups that most of us have never heard of, and yet they're heavily funded and they have a lot of influence.
Absolutely. It's all dark money, which makes it very difficult to track, meaning that conservative billionaires are investing millions, tens of millions of dollars into the election denial movement. These dollars are getting ping-ponged between dark money funding organizations, nonprofits and their subsidiaries, and it makes it very difficult and sometimes impossible to track. And you have legendary journalists like Jane Mayer who have dedicated her career to tracking this kind of money. But so one of the main funders of election denial is a small and little known but extremely powerful funder known as the Bradley Foundation. It distributes tens of millions of dollars across the movement that get trickled down into groups like the Election Integrity Network, which is an initiative really at the center of election denial and closely connected to the Heritage Foundation. There was a report that came out yesterday from the Wall Street Journal that also looks into these these donor networks and found that a secretive network of Republican donors and conservative billionaires have given more than $140 million to 50 loosely connected groups that work together on what they call election integrity, but really is an attempt to undermine the public trust in elections. So there is a lot of money flowing through this. It's difficult to track, but we in Media Matters have really been paying attention to the best journalists on this out there and trying to communicate their findings to our audience.
Okay, what else do you know about the Bradley Foundation? You all write that Cleta Mitchell, the election denier, is on the board of the funding organization, the Bradley Foundation. Jane Mayer, as you said, has been doing a lot of reporting on this. They fund a number of right-wing groups, including the Heritage Foundation, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, Honest Elections Project, and many more. According to Jane Mayer, an animating force behind the Bradley Foundation's war on election fraud, quote unquote, is Cleta Mitchell. Mitchell and the Election Integrity Network are fierce supporters of rule changes instituted by the Georgia State Elections Board that could undermine election result certification in the state.
So the Lynn and Harry Bradley Foundation is a Wisconsin-based private tax-exempt organization that is a hub for distributing money across the conservative movement for a wide variety of pet issues, but most concerningly at the moment is these challenges to the election rules in an attempt to undermine free and fair elections. This was once the strategy just of the far right, but in recent years, since 2020 especially, the right-wing movement has been preparing for the moment that we are in now. And the Bradley Foundation has been a key enabler of this agenda. They have an endowment of around $850 million, and they have been spending tens of millions of dollars on these so-called election integrity groups. The Bradley Foundation also has ties to the infamous John Birch Society, which was a anti-communist conspiracy organization that became the breeding ground for a lot of the extreme right that you're seeing today. So this is a long existing organization that since 2020 has really come to the forefront of this election denial movement, and they're better organized than ever. They've been preparing for 4 years to litigate, to flood the zone with lawsuits, to disenfranchise voters, to spread misinformation, and discourage Democratic voters from getting out the vote. And so it's critical that people are aware of their place in counteracting this by staying aware of this type of organizing and making sure that their voices are heard.
We're joined today by Madeline Peltz, co-author of the new Media Matters report called Project 2025 Allies Are Organizing to Steal the Election. I'm glad that you went there because I was going to ask you to give us the big picture. I mean, you have sections in your report on all of these various groups: ALEC, the Conservative Partnership Institute, the Center for Renewing America, the Honest Elections Project, on and on. But when you look at what they're doing, and then you look at where we are right now, 12 days to the election, and in swing states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, North Carolina, can you give us a sense of how this is all playing out on the ground? And what do you all expect if the election is close or if Donald Trump loses?
One thing that we're seeing, especially on the ground, are these rule changes that have come through the Georgia State Election Board in elections in the last few years. Pro-Trump MAGA loyalists have been elected as the majority on the state election board, and they have passed a collection of rules that would make it easier to delay certification of the vote, to raise unfounded concerns about fraud in the sort of fog of war that is counting the ballots. And some of these rules are extremely vague. They lack deadlines, and so they could be a way to run out the clock on certification, and which could, frankly, tip off a constitutional crisis if this is really a photo finish that we're seeing here. So I think one really big hotspot is Georgia. Some of these rules have been blocked by judges in the state, and some are in the middle of being litigated. So it's definitely an active state of play. But what's happening on the ground in Georgia is really, really concerning. You also have election denial organizations in Pennsylvania that are seeking to overturn, to throw out overseas ballots. That has been a really big focus of the right at the moment, is conspiracy theories about overseas voters and military voters who are serving overseas. They are really seeking to disenfranchise those voters. And so those are two hotspots that we're watching. It's hard to say what's going to happen, but it's definitely at the forefront of what we're paying attention to at Media Matters.
I'm glad you flagged this New York Times article in your report that came out last month by Alexandra Berzon, Republicans Seize on False Theories About Immigrant Voting. I mean, this is just really ugly, racist, and could be potentially dangerous. So the Times is reporting about what's happening in Georgia. It's completely connected to what you just laid out. The Times writes, one woman, a local party chair from Georgia, recommended scouring school enrollment figures to find neighborhoods with large numbers of migrants. Another, Darlene Hennessy, an activist from the Detroit area, recommended hanging up signs in, quote, ethnic neighborhoods, warning people not to vote if they were not eligible. She also suggested searching voter rolls for certain types of surnames. I mean, this is just so ugly. Hennessy told, according to a recording of a call obtained by the New York Times, I think it's unfortunate, but sometimes the only way you can find out is to look for ethnic names. We don't want to be doing anything legal. You know, what's so sad about this, Madeline, is first of all that this is even happening in the first place, but what's scary about it is people believe these things. And we saw what happened last time when they showed up to election offices. And I've read reports about people having these emergency buttons in their office in case something happens close to or on election day.
The election denial movement has explicitly endorsed racial profiling as a strategy to hunt out what this imaginary non-citizen voter. You mentioned the report in the New York Times about this search for, quote, ethnic names. We at Media Matters have aggregated that example and others throughout the mainstream media of similar incidents. You have an election denial leader in North Carolina saying that you need to look for quote, Hispanic sounding last names that they believe are, quote, suspicious. You also have a group that has planned to hand out flyers outside of, quote, Latino churches in both English and Spanish that say, if you are that warn about non-citizen voting, and civil rights activists, or sorry, experts have warned that these types of activities, not only is non-citizen voting nearly invisible, if but also this hullabaloo over it intimidates immigrant voters, naturalized citizens, and communities of color from voting. And so you really see that this at the center of the election denial movement at the moment is this panic over non-citizen voters, and it really knits together Trump's long-standing calls to, quote, stop the steal with the xenophobic, racist, anti-immigrant sentiment that is prolific across the MAGA base. Those two things are coming together to create a really potent disinformation narrative.
And I just want to mention, if anyone wants to read about these emergency buttons, NBC reported in August, local Georgia officials equip election workers with panic buttons to combat rising threats. Cobb County, Georgia approved nearly $50,000 to purchase the devices, which allow poll workers to quickly alert authorities in emergencies. So this is what it's come to. Madeline, before we let you go, what else are you and your colleagues going to be looking out for in the coming days leading up to the election?
We're looking for anything that signals where these election denial organizations are active and what impact they're having on the ground. So we watch the right-wing media very closely in these small fringe spaces that don't get a lot of viewers. You see them telegraphing their plans and tactics, and we are trying to get ahead of that and let people know about how their vote is being targeted for disenfranchisement. So that's something we're paying very close attention to over here at Media Matters, and we will continue to not only for the next 12 days, but also through the end of election season.
Madeline Peltz is co-author of the new Media Matters report called Project 2025 Allies or Organizing to Steal the Election. Madeline is Deputy Director of Rapid Response at Media Matters. Madeline, thanks to you and your team for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. One of the top stories at Media Matters is called Newspaper Front Pages Ignore Trump's Former Chief of Staff, Saying the Former President is a Fascist Who Praised Hitler. Even though John Kelly went on the record saying Trump is a fascist and that he has expressed admiration for Adolf Hitler and he repeatedly denigrating soldiers and the military, the story was not featured on the front pages of the New York Times, which published that feature, or the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, USA Today, or the Wall Street Journal. Coming up after a break, we will continue our series on Project 2025 by talking about Idaho, a cautionary tale of life under a Project 2025 abortion ban. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to discuss Project 2025 and abortion. Since the conservatives on the Supreme Court overturned Roe 2 years ago, 14 states have enacted near total abortion bans. Another four have banned abortion past roughly 6 weeks of pregnancy, according to The Guardian. Project 2025 would restrict abortion access even further. In a recent piece about what is at stake in the election, The Guardian reporter Carter Sherman looks at how the authors of Project 2025 propose using the Comstock Act, an 1873 anti-vice law, to prohibit the shipping of abortion pills and possibly even equipment used by abortion clinics by mail. That would effectively create a national abortion ban. Carter Sherman writes that if Donald Trump wins the presidency, even abortion access for women in blue states may be under threat. Carter Sherman recently reported from Idaho, which has one of the strictest abortion bans in the country. She writes that the stories of women being denied abortions, even when their lives are at risk, and doctors fleeing the state in droves, serves as a cautionary tale of what could happen to reproductive care across the country if Project 2025's measures are enacted. Carter Sherman is a reproductive health and justice reporter for The Guardian. Hi, Carter. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back, Carter. I wanted to ask you an overall question about abortion coverage. Given that so much has changed since Roe was overturned and so many brave women have been sharing their stories, what are your thoughts about major media coverage of abortion? What has changed, and then what is at stake if Donald Trump wins?
Well, the major change, I would say, is that there is a lot more of this kind of coverage. I have been covering abortion rights for, I guess, 8 years now. And for a long time, I would say that there was really only a handful of reporters who were dedicated to this beat. Many of those reporters are still working now, but there are so many more folks who are interested in this issue and paying attention to it. I mean, I think this issue is incredibly important, and I'm really glad that there's not only more journalists on this beat, but there's more interest from the American people on it. That said, I think in looking at the coverage of this election, There's been so much focus on whether or not Donald Trump would sign or veto a national abortion ban. And I think that focus can kind of obscure what the real policies could be under a Trump administration and how those could really impact people across the country.
Yeah, and I was very shocked to learn that 17% of voters blame President Biden for the end of Roe. This is a poll that came out. I read about this in the New York Times. It was back in May. And this is a poll from the New York Times and Siena College. They looked at Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, and Wisconsin. And they found that nearly one in five voters in battleground states say that Biden is responsible for ending the right to an abortion. What are your thoughts on this?
I think this is probably a symptom of what I like to call a lack of abortion literacy in the United States. There are many, many people who have extraordinarily strong opinions on abortion, but not many people are totally informed on abortion law and abortion medicine and abortion politics. And there are also certainly plenty of people who are not really informed about how the Supreme Court works or how Donald Trump was the person who put three of the justices on the court who then voted to overturn Roe v. Wade. I think it's unfortunate, but I do understand that so many folks have so many other things going on in their lives. The question for me is always going to end up being, how does that impact how folks vote if they vote? Are people really thinking about abortion as one of their top issues in this election?
Right. And the polling shows that support for abortion is even higher now because of what happened to Roe. It's at about 80%. And you write, Carter, and this is not your opinion, this is just a fact, that if Donald Trump wins the presidency, even abortion access for women in blue states may be under threat. But a lot of people do not know this for the reasons that you just laid out.
That's very true. I think there's a sentiment, particularly in blue states, that I've even encountered where people think, oh, well, I live in a liberal state. My abortion rights will be protected. I don't need to necessarily worry about what is going on in Texas or Alabama or Idaho. And I think, frankly, there is a sentiment that, that's the kind of thing that happens in Texas. People can just leave and move and come to my blue state if they want abortion access. But the fact of the matter is, it's really difficult for folks to just uproot their lives. And we should really be looking at these states that have abortion bans as potentially a harbinger of what could happen to everybody else in this country.
You have a recent devastating piece about what's happening in Idaho. Women and doctors describe heart-wrenching decisions under what may be the United States' strictest abortion ban in Idaho. So, can you tell us what is the law in Idaho today?
Yeah, so the law in Idaho is that if there is a medical emergency, a doctor can only intervene and provide abortion care if a patient's life is at risk. Now, every abortion ban in this country does allow for abortions in medical emergencies, but many of those bans technically allow doctors to intervene when a patient's health is at risk. So that is a broader category of interventions. And, doctors even in those states say that the laws are really unclear. It's very hard for them to know when to intervene. So oftentimes they do wait until patients are on the brink of death and then try to pull them back. But Idaho has gone further by actually putting that only in life-threatening situations can you do an abortion into law. Now, right, that case actually, or that law actually ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court, which heard arguments over this law and whether or not it violated a federal law known as EMTALA. And what EMTALA says is that if someone turns up at a hospital and they're in the midst of a medical emergency, that hospital has to stabilize them or send them somewhere where they can get stabilizing care. They can't just turn people away. The Biden administration said that because abortions in Idaho are only allowed in life-threatening circumstances, that is a violation of EMTALA. What the Supreme Court ultimately did is not really rule on the case. They sent it back to lower courts and allowed a broader range of emergency abortions to be performed in Idaho. But what this means is that we don't really have an answer about how EMTALA could be interpreted under, say, a future Trump administration.
You write that Idaho pushed back, arguing in part that the federal government cannot compel doctors to offer care that is illegal under state law. And without a Democrat in the White House to fight this, Idaho's interpretation of EMTALA could end up becoming a widespread standard.
Yes. I mean, I think it's clear, but the Biden administration sued. Would a Trump administration sue Idaho over a similar circumstance? We've actually already begun to see sort of a fracturing of the EMTALA enforcement. A court has recently ruled that in Texas, EMTALA does not quite apply in the same way, and that indeed it might be possible for doctors to not perform abortions in these sort of emergency situations that EMTALA would otherwise require them to do. So what we're looking at is a situation where a federal law means different things in different states.
Have you been able to interview any of these Republican politicians that are pushing for and have successfully implemented these extreme bans? I mean, to think that someone shows up at a hospital and needs emergency care, and the doctors, because of law, cannot help them. Have you been able to ask any politicians about this?
Over the course of my time reporting on abortion, I have talked to them about these kinds of circumstances. And I think, we also see their rhetoric in the news. They talk about this. And I think in a lot of circumstances, they think that it is doctors who are misinterpreting the laws and that the laws are clear as written. It's the doctors who have this issue and they need to sort it out amongst themselves. But doctors keep on saying, we don't know how these laws work. We're very afraid. Many of these laws carry criminal penalties if you violate them. And these doctors are looking for information about how to interpret stuff. And it just seems like we're not necessarily going to get that anytime soon.
This is also so important. You write that many doctors have left Idaho rather than work under its ban. In the 15 months after Idaho's abortion ban took effect, 22% of Idaho obstetricians stopped working in the state. This is according to a report by the Idaho Physician Wellbeing Action Collaborative. Three labor and delivery wards have closed. More than half of Idaho's nine maternal fetal medicine specialists have left or stopped working in the state full time. And this is not just Idaho. This is in so many conservative states. Do you think that are we only beginning to understand what this actually means for care in these states?
Oh, for sure. I think we've already started to see stories of women come forward who say they were denied medically necessary abortions, but we're also only just beginning to get the research about what this has meant for people. For example, there have been two studies now that took a look at maternal mortality rates, or sorry, infant mortality rates in the wake of the implementation of abortion bans. And we have seen that there are more infants that die in the wake of these bans being implemented. In particular, many of the infants who pass away are ones that have some kind of congenital anomaly. And so the thinking is that what has happened is that these are circumstances under which someone who might get this diagnosis would probably get an abortion, but they might live in a state where it's no longer an option for them to do that. I also think that, as, doctors leave states with abortion bans, we're also starting to see that doctors don't want to move into those states with abortion bans. We're seeing fewer residents want to do their residencies in states with abortion bans. And this is only going to create, if this pattern continues, a greater disparity among states that have access to abortion and those that don't. And it's not just going to affect abortion access, it's going to affect the kinds of care that people get throughout pregnancy.
Right. Well, and then to think about what these doctors are having to deal with, you interviewed Dr. Kylie Cooper in Idaho. She and her husband just were talking about the possibilities. Would she go to jail immediately? Could she get bail? What would that mean for their small children? Eventually, Dr. Cooper thought, what are we even doing?
Yeah, that was a really sobering conversation, I think, and a deeply emotional one. I've actually talked to many, many family medicine physicians and OBGYNs in Idaho and those who have left Idaho because of these bans. And I think in every case, these doctors feel so bad. They feel like they have been forced to choose between their patients' lives and their own. And it just creates a profound sense of moral distress where they have to be in these situations where they're weighing, okay, I want to save and protect this patient, but I'm also very afraid of going to jail. I want to be able to help the next patient. I can't do that if I'm in jail. It just becomes really untenable, and people leave rather than having to deal with it.
Today, we are speaking with Carter Sherman, a reproductive health and justice reporter for The Guardian. Carter has done fantastic reporting on what has happened since the conservatives on the Supreme Court overturned Roe. She's been covering abortion for many, many years. She also looks at how the authors of Project 2025 propose using the Comstock Act. It's an 1873 anti-vice law to prohibit the shipping of abortion pills and possibly even equipment used by abortion clinics, and that would effectively create a national abortion ban. She writes that if Donald Trump wins in just 12 days, even abortion access for women in blue states may be under threat. Carter, you tell just really sad stories about people like Jennifer Atkins, Rebecca Schaffner, and so many brave women and young women have told their horrible stories about whether it's a fetal anomaly that happened to their baby or something that was really tragic that happened to their baby, or in the case of, her name's escaping me now,
Hadley Duvall.
Thank you. Hadley Duvall. I mean, she was raped by her stepfather at the age of 12. I mean, they're telling these horrific stories. What are you hearing from your readers when you share stories about people like Jennifer Atkins, for example? You write that her first pregnancy had gone so smoothly, she didn't need an epidural when she gave birth. She thought her next pregnancy would be the same, but in April of last year, 12 weeks in, an ultrasound scan shattered that hope. It indicated a litany of issues with her fetus. How do readers respond when you share these stories?
I think that the reason that so many of these stories have really resonated with people is because people did not know that this could happen if an abortion ban took effect. They didn't understand the extent to which a ban would impact not only folks who might be looking for an abortion, might want to end their pregnancies, but people who have deeply wanted pregnancies and something goes wrong and they are backed into a corner where they would like to end the pregnancy to either spare what they see as their baby from further pain or to protect their own lives, to make sure that they can be around for their family. You know, we've actually seen many of these women come out on the campaign trail and talk for originally, Biden when he was the nominee and now Kamala Harris. And I think that it just shows how profoundly access to abortion has become interwoven into how people conceive of their lives and make decisions around pregnancy and make decisions around just reproductive care overall. Again, what it comes back to me, though, is I always wonder, to what extent are people actually going to end up voting like this?
Well, that's right, because I often ask our guests, what explains the disconnect between 80% of the country supporting abortion rights? We've got 10 abortion rights measures on ballots across the country in 10 different states. And we're finding that even in very conservative parts of the country, abortion rights win. And yet the extreme anti-abortion politicians also win. How do you explain that?
I think people don't oftentimes connect their vote to a Republican or their votes for a Republican to abortion rights. I think we're starting to see actually reporting out of Arizona, for example, where this is the case. They have a ballot measure in Arizona that would amend the state constitution to protect abortion rights. But there are people who are seemingly willing to split ticket effectively and vote for in favor of that ballot measure and then also vote for their preferred Republican candidate. I think what these ballot measures sort of do, perhaps inadvertently, is give people a bit of an off-ramp where they can say, okay, I know I support abortion rights and I want to vote in favor of a ballot measure, but I am also Republican and I hold on to that identity very strongly. And so I still will end up voting for a Republican candidate. I think people have also they understand abortion rights to now be a states' rights issue. I mean, that is how Republicans often talk about it. But, you know, as you've mentioned with Project 2025, it's really not just a states' rights issue. There are things that a president in the White House can do to protect or limit abortion access. And so the way you vote for federal candidates does end up impacting how abortion access functions in this country.
Can you also talk about the reporting you've done on girls? Because I think a lot about girls and how these laws are affecting them. The Washington Post, did you see this piece by Karen Brouillard a few days ago called "A Young Teen Gives Birth, Idaho's Parental Consent Law Snags Her Care"?
Oh, I don't think I did.
Oh my gosh, it's a devastating story. There's a photo of this young, she's my niece's age. It's so unbelievable. Her name's Alia, and she's pregnant, 13, and she looks on at her baby shower. I just think this is all about the parental consent laws. And I think about the debate between Ted Cruz and Colin Allred in Texas. And Ted Cruz thought that he was scoring points by pointing out that Colin Allred voted against a parental consent law. Well, in this case, Alia's mom is living in a car. Her grandma is her legal guardian. The grandma gave verbal consent for an exam when she went to the hospital from a jail where the grandma is incarcerated on drug charges. And so this poor girl, 13 years old, is 36 weeks pregnant. What are your thoughts about this, Carter, and how these laws are affecting young girls?
Parental consent laws are actually something that I've paid a lot of attention to over the years, and I think they're a very interesting case study, oftentimes in the direction of abortion rights. You know, parental consent laws are actually very, or parental involvement laws, I should say, are pretty popular with Americans. There are many states that have some kind of law on the books that say if you want to get an abortion and you're a minor, you have to either notify your parent or get their consent to actually have that procedure. But I also think a lot of people don't necessarily know that these laws are on the books or know how they necessarily play out for young people. You know, there have been a case, at least one case that I'm aware of, where in the 80s, a 17-year-old girl passed away because it's suspected she got an illegal abortion because she lived in a state that had a parental involvement law and she didn't feel like she could tell her parents that she wanted to end her pregnancy. And her mom, later speaking to the New York Times, talked about how this is a law she would have voted for and she would have supported. And now her daughter has passed away. And I think this is the sort of thing that, you know, again, people don't always look at the consequences of what can happen when an abortion ban is implemented, even when there are these sort of like, even when you think that I'm a parent and I would like to be involved with my child's abortion decision.
Well, Alia had the baby, and there are photos of a 13-year-old holding her newborn baby. This is just, it's just shocking that this is happening. Is there any way to know at this point, Carter, how many teenagers are having babies because of these abortion bans?
That is not a statistic I'm familiar with at this time. We do know that it seems like there have been more births since the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the implementation of abortion bans. I think this is a lot of research that's going to be coming out in the years to come. You know, regardless of the outcome of this presidential election, the American debate over abortion is certainly not going to be over, and we're going to be seeing the reverberations of overturning Roe for likely the rest of my lifetime.
Right. We don't have time to take Greg's call, but he wanted to ask you, is reporting on abortion and Project 2025 making an impact on voters in red states or swing states?
I honestly am not quite sure. It's very clear that the election is extraordinarily close. And so I think this is the sort of thing where we're going to see on election day to what extent people care this much about abortion or have been paying attention to the stories that have been coming out of states where there has been an abortion ban.
You also mentioned this earlier, but you have a story about hundreds more babies in the United States dying than expected in the months after Roe was overturned. You also have a couple of stories about what's happening in Florida and Florida suing over attempts to shut down a TV ad in favor of abortion rights. Can you just give us the thumbnail sketch of what's going on there with Governor Ron DeSantis?
Sure. So Florida is one of the states that has an abortion-related ballot measure coming up in November. And that abortion-related ballot measure would amend the state constitution to enshrine abortion rights into it. And it would lead to the rollback of Florida's current 6-week abortion ban. It also needs 60% of the vote to pass, which is the highest threshold we have ever seen a post-Roe abortion-related ballot measure need to garner. And the polling right now looks a little shaky about whether or not it will actually end up getting that 60% of the vote. Now, what the Florida government has done in recent weeks is take several steps to try to effectively defeat the measure, to say that Amendment 4, as it's called, is too extreme, that it goes further than what is necessarily being portrayed to voters. In fact, parental consent laws have come up a lot in Florida recently, where there's been claims made that Amendment 4 would roll back the state's parental consent law and make it so that parents only need to be notified if their child is going to have an abortion. I've talked to experts who say that those claims are overblown. But I think what we're going to be seeing in Florida is a question about, is it possible for abortion opponents to defeat these kinds of ballot measures? And if so, what kind of steps do they need to take? We know that abortion rights are very popular. We also know that people don't always vote like that. And I'm paying a lot of attention to Florida and to see if this becomes a kind of playbook for other states that might be looking to defeat ballot measures in the future.
And then to take it back to Project 2025 and Trump, again, you report that Project 2025 proposes using the Comstock Act to make abortion illegal across the country. Without even involving Congress, Donald Trump could use the Comstock Act to implement a nationwide de facto abortion ban. And if he doesn't, the courts could. Anti-abortion activists have begun to seed lawsuits throughout the country that cite Comstock, while the Supreme Court's far-right justices, Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, brought up the 150-year-old law in recent arguments. So in our final minute, Carter, can you once again just remind us what is at stake here with Project 2025 and what happens if Trump wins?
Yeah, so the Comstock Act, as you said, is a 1873 anti-vice law that technically bans the mailing of all abortion-related materials. Now, under Roe v. Wade, the Comstock Act was not being enforced in that way. But now that Roe is gone, some anti-abortion activists, including folks over at Project 2025, have started to say that actually Comstock is good law and we should be able to enforce it. Specifically, what Project 2025 says is that it can be used to ban the mailing of abortion pills, which account for two-thirds of all abortions in the United States. So that kind of implementation of Comstock would obviously have a huge impact on people's access to abortion. Other activists outside of Project 2025 go even further and say that actually you can use Comstock to even ban the mailing of, say, the equipment that abortion clinics use to do their jobs. And what that would result in would be a de facto nationwide abortion ban in all likelihood, because clinics and abortion providers rely on the mail to do their jobs.
Well, Carter, thank you so much for your important reporting. Carter Sherman is a reproductive health and justice reporter with The Guardian. Thank you, Carter, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can learn more about all of the articles and the information that we shared today by going to kalw.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is KALW, San Francisco Bay Area.